first reading this morning comes from the Song of Songs, chapter 2, verses 10 through 13 from the Hebrew Scriptures. Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on earth, the time of the singing of birds has come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. The fig tree putteth forth her green figs, and the vines with the tender grapes give a good smell. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. And then the second reading is a poem from Rumi. Glorious is the moment we sit in the palace, you and I. Two forms, two faces, but a single soul, you and I. The flowers will blaze and bird cries shower us with immortality. The moment we enter the garden, you and I, what a miracle, you and I. One love, one love, one fire. In this world, in the next, in an ecstasy without end.
This reading is from Joseph Campbell's The Power of Myth, the chapter Tales of Love and Marriage. Campbell says, the medieval troubadours were poets of a certain character, yes. The period for the troubadours is the 12th century. The whole troubadour tradition was extinguished in Provence in the so-called Albigensian Crusade of 1209, which was launched by Pope Innocent III, and which is regarded as one of the most monstrous crusades in the history of Europe. The troubadours became associated with the Manichaean heresy of the Albigensians that was rampant at that time. Though the Albigensian movement was really a protest against the corruption of the medieval clergy. So the troubadours and their transformation of the idea of love got mixed up in the religious life in a very complicated way. Moyer says, the transformation of love, what do you mean? Campbell, the troubadours were very much interested in the psychology of love, and they're the first ones in the West who really thought of love the way we do now, as a person-to-person relationship. Moyers, what had it been before that? Campbell, before that, love was simply Eros, the god who excites you to sexual desire. This is not the experience of falling in love the way the troubadours understood it. Eros is much more impersonal than falling in love. You see, people didn't know about amour. It is something personable that the troubadours recognized. Eros and agape are impersonal loves. Moyers, explain. Campbell, Eros is a biological urge. It's the zeal of the organs for each other. The personal factor doesn't matter. Moyers, and agape? Campbell, agape is love thy neighbor as thyself, spiritual love. It doesn't matter who the neighbor is. Moyers, now this is not passion in the sense that Eros mandates it. This is compassion, I would think. Campbell, yes, it is compassion. It is a heart opening, but it is not individuated as Amar is. With Amar, we have a purely personal ideal, the kind of seizure that comes from the meeting of the eyes, as they say in the troubadour tradition, is a person-to-person experience. And that's completely contrary to everything the church stood for. It's a personal, individual experience. And I think it's the essential thing that's great about the West and that what makes it different from all other traditions. Moyers, I know. So the courage to love became the courage to affirm one's own experience against tradition, the tradition of the church.
We continue our series on Joseph Campbell's Power of Myth. And how appropriate that on this Sunday, after the events in Austin, Texas this last week, that we're talking about marriage and the sacred marriage. It's interesting because I remember when I first read The Power of Myth, and he was talking about these great cultural myths in various forms, and a whole chapter was devoted to love and marriage. I was sort of surprised by that. But Campbell says that the idea of love is core to our mythology. We think of myth as mainly dealing with the issues of life and death, birth, and the stages of life. But Campbell reminds us that marriage, or the yearning for union with another or others, even friends and family, is a core part of who we are as a culture and as a world. And so we want to address that today. It's interesting because I remember when I was taking Greek class years and years ago, there was all this talk about how agape is the love to strive for, and eros, oh, stay away from eros. But the ancient Greeks had multiple words for love. One was eros, which wasn't just sexual, but it was also passion. Matthew Fox talks about compassion and justice as erotic justice, that which is passion, that which draws deep down from the core part of yourself. And then there's also agape, which Campbell mentions is that spiritual love, that unconditional love, that word that Paul uses in his famous hymn in 1 Corinthians 13, where he challenges the church to love in a way that transcends any of their divisions, any of their personal struggles, and there were many in Corinth. And that love, if you hold on to agape, it will be the thing that lasts in the end, Paul says. But there was also another kind of love, which we have hints of in some of the names of our cities. Philia, the brotherly love, the sisterly love, that familial kind of connection that we have that's more it's more on the same level and doesn't require that same unconditional sense that agape has, but this idea that we are connected in community. But there's another word that doesn't get talked about a lot, and that's agarpe. Agarpa it comes from the word farmer, agra, and in the Greek, and it had to do with the familial love that you have for a child or a parent or a family member that's even different than philia. So all these were floating around, and then Virgil comes along in the first century, who wasn't a Greek but a Roman, and he introduces this idea of amor, and says that it is something that's different altogether. It is the kind of love, and Virgil talks about it as a seizure. Something as Campbell mentions too, when the eyes meet, there's something that occurs. It's not planned, it's not organized, and it's not impersonal. It's very personal. It is this sense that I have known you all my life, perhaps, or this sense of connection. And Virgil says that this can happen not just with a lover, but also with certain friendships that occur. That there's this sense of connection, of knowing, that isn't a rational choice, and we must listen to that. And what was so radical about that is that's not the way things were structured in antiquity. Things were prescribed. Let me give you a hint. You know, when people say, let's return to the biblical values of marriage, let me tell you what the biblical values of marriage was at the time of Jesus. About 2 months after a little girl went into her first period, she was arranged to be married to usually a man who was twice her age. So that would have been the case of Mary and Joseph and many others. Someone who would provide for her, and she would provide children, right? And so these were arranged marriages. They were usually familial. There was usually some attachment to it with property or the possibility of property or livelihood. This was the biblical understanding of marriage. And that, of course, had evolved from times even before then when, yes, you could make arranged marriages, but the males could also have other opportunities along the way with their slave women, etc., where women were completely out of any kind of choosing. And so when we talk about biblical values and biblical marriage, this is what we're really talking about. Now, Jesus quotes the passage from Genesis where he says, "And the two shall become one flesh." But in all the Hebrew writings, we learned that this was not really a discussion of marriage. This was a discussion of how babies are made. It doesn't say the two shall become one. It says the two shall become one flesh, which is just basic biology, right? And so that's what that was affirming from the Adam and Eve story. Now, I remember taking a marriage encounter workshop years ago, and the workshop leader said, if you've ever been in a relationship and you have this ideal that the two shall become one, that each of you are a half, and when you join together, you'll truly find unity. He says, it doesn't work like that in marriage. If you come together as two halves, it works like multiplication. You actually become a fourth in your relationship. He said, so the best way to approach a marriage is two wholes, two complete persons who come to each other in love. And then you have the possibility of a relationship. Wow, what a concept. And so marriage has evolved over the years. A fellow by the name of John Boswell, who's now deceased, a great Harvard scholar, wrote a book in the early 80s that discusses how the very first marriages, and this may be a shock even to folks at Trinity, the very first marriages that were documented that were done by the church were between two males. How many of you have ever heard that before? Some of you have. It's a very, and he was a historian, and he actually shows this and shows multiple cases, records of this. Now here's the deal. Marriage was something controlled by the state, by Rome. And so it was done outside of any religious organization. There were ceremonies that were done in Judaism, but the early church, which was mostly Gentile, followed the rules of the Roman Empire when it came to marriage. And it wasn't until about the 4th century, when Christianity became a part of the Roman Empire, that the church started actually doing blessings of marriage in the church. But those first ones were done for people that the state would not recognize. Isn't that interesting? Sometimes they were males who were lovers, no doubt. Other times they were males who had business arrangements, and if they were to lose somehow that arrangement, if one of them would die while the other was still alive, they would lose all of their resources. And so the church started doing blessings for those kinds of relationships. So we're just wrapping back around to where we started. Now, I am a cynic when it comes to those kinds of historic analysis. I like that idea, but I had to read John Boswell myself to really believe this documentation of these particular incidences. And that's because, if you remember, marriage wasn't about love. Marriage was about arrangements. Even in Jesus' day, it wasn't about love. It was about producing children. It was about dowries and property. And if you've ever been through a divorce, like I have, And even if you haven't, if you know anything about the legal profession, you will discover that when you are in the midst of the legal proceedings around divorce, that there's nothing in there about love. Nothing. It's all about property. It's all about what you hold and what you don't hold and how that's going to be divided up. I was sitting there in the midst of my own divorce proceedings and going through all this paperwork and going, how absurd is it that a minister can sign a marriage license in this country? Because I'm all about counseling couples about love, about covenant, about faithfulness, about compassion with one another. I've never sat down with a ledger sheet and asked them to look at their property and how it's divided out. And yet that's what the whole thing is about legally. And so it dawned on me that we've got some old thing going on when there was no separation of church and state where clergy can still sign the marriage license when we have no business signing the marriage license. Because it's not about what we're talking about. It's about legal status. And so marriage to this day in this country and around the world is about legal status. It is about how property is divided at one level. But isn't it interesting that even as the courts are wrestling with the whole issue of gay marriage, and even when you have issues like here in Texas, where a woman is dying of cancer and her partner needs to have legal status, that even in the midst of that, when you hear these judges making statements and you hear politicians making statements that are in support of gay marriage, what they wrap around to over and over again is the right of people to be able to choose who they want to be married to. Wow. And so at some level, and you'll read these judges' remarks, and they're saying, shouldn't people be able to love whom they choose to love? So you've got the legal folks even talking about love. And so one of the things that I'm hoping is that this whole thing about gay marriage will actually get us all thinking about what does it mean to be married? What does it mean to be connected to another by choice? It's this whole thing of it being around love is a fairly new thing. Even my great-grandparents, in letters that I've read about their marriage, it was clear that while they had some sort of affection toward one another, it was mostly people that they knew in the community. It just seemed like the right thing to do, hooking up together, getting together, marrying. And love was not part of the formula often. That is a new kind of thing. But Campbell reminds us that when the troubadours came around in the Middle Ages, in the 12th century, and talking about love, they were pushing up against a system where it was all arranged, where it was all legal, and saying, love ultimately has to be about something else. And this idea of amour, Campbell talks about even, he says, isn't it interesting that the if you spell amour backwards, it's Roma. Right? Just, I think it's ironic. I don't think Virgil intended that. But they were pushing up against a system that said everything has to be done according to legal status, and that's what a marriage constitutes. But the troubadours were saying, no, it's based on the heart. It's based on your meeting of the eyes. It's based on amour. What was so radical about it is that that's not how things were arranged. That's not how things were done. So it didn't just challenge the institution of marriage. It challenged the authority of the church, which said, That's not what you base a marriage on. Marriage is based on arrangements that are prescribed to you by the authorities. So amour, this idea that you could fall in love and it might not even be the person that had been arranged for you, that shakes up the whole institution of the church. And folks, the stuff that's going on right now with gay marriage is shaking up the institution of the church. When I was first involved in reconciling LGBT stuff back in the late 80s, early 90s, the activists who were very involved and had been involved for a long time said, marriage is the wrong area to focus. That's a straight thing. We're not about that. But over the years, it's been interesting that the whole idea of marriage became this lightning rod for trying to understand what it means to have legal recognition, but also what it means to be two adults in the world and to hold to the value of love. And so it has become the thing. Now, I believe that when gay marriage is throughout the land, and I think that's probably going to happen this summer, probably by the end of June, what's very clear is that we're still going to have major issues of discrimination against LGBTQ people in our society. I remember, and some of you will remember, in 2008, when we're watching this African-American man accept the nomination for presidency, there was this feeling, oh, wow, we are in some new place in this country. But what's become clear over the last 6 years is that we're not really in a new place when it comes to race. It's brought out so much hatred, so much vitriol. The same thing will happen, I believe, with LGBTQ stuff. And so we will not be able to rest. We will need to continue on that vigil. And what is that vigil? It is the song of the bard, the song of the troubadour, that says, amour, amour, amour. Love, love, love. It is the core part of our biology. It is, according to Campbell, one of the most important mythologies to weave your life around. And even if you're not in relationship with anyone at this particular moment, it is still a part of our humanness, a part of our core self, who we are. Now, the Song of Songs, which was read a few minutes ago, is a song of love. And the ancient Jewish community had a difficult time including it in their Hebrew scriptures. At the Council of Jamnia in 90, when they were figuring out the final books to put in the Hebrew Bible, there was a huge discussion about how the Song of Songs should not be in there because it's about love and sex. And what does that have to do with faithfulness? And some wise rabbis who really loved the Song of Songs said, it's not really about love and sex. It's about God's love for the people of Israel. It's a metaphor. And so it got in there. And then the early church that had a difficult time with some of those Hebrew scriptures said, it's about Christ's love for the church, not about sex. Well, folks, that's not right. It's about love. It's about sex. But here's another cool thing. At the same time that the troubadours were singing about amour, the mystics in Judaism, in Islam, in Christianity, drew from these same texts of the Song of Songs to talk about what it means to relate to God as a lover, and that you are the beloved. If you read the poem Dark Night of the Soul by John of the Cross, if you read Rumi, where he talks about everything framed between the beloved and the lover, you get the sense that amour is not just for the human plane. that there is a place for being so in love with God and so in union with God that it is like eyes meeting and being transformed. So this isn't just about a myth of human relationship. It's about how we dance with the divine all around us. And the troubadours believed that amour was accessible on the human plane, but it also was accessible on the divine plane. And so it wasn't just up to the priests anymore to define God's love. That everyone, man and woman, rich and poor, churched and unchurched, could find the sacred marriage with the divine. What a powerful concept. When we're talking about gay marriage, when we're talking about love between two people, when we're talking about what it means to relate to God, what would it mean if our mythology of love got all wrapped in there together and we committed to that path of amour? That's what Campbell was talking about in The Power of Myth. That's what we need to hold on to in our own lives. Amen.